Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Truman and today I'm joined by Paul Clark and Richard Dufty of the Bristol-based performance collective Uninvited Guests. The company, which also includes Jessica Hoffman and regular collaborator Lewis Gibson, are currently presenting their newest work, Make Better Please, at the Battersea Arts Centre in London as part of a series of dates around the UK. Starting from the day's newspapers, the show attempts to banish whatever demons might be troubling the audience with a contemporary shamanic ritual of sorts. Like their previous piece, Love Letters Straight From Your Heart, itself a subject of a rare five-star rave from The Guardian 2 years ago, Make Better Please generates a lot of its content in collaboration with its particular audience. Where love letters ask for love songs and heartfelt dedications, Make Better Please wants to know what really makes us angry. Paul and Richard, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello.
So I thought we'd start by going right back to the beginning and saying, what was the inspiration? Where did the initial impulse to make this quite remarkable piece of work come from?
Make Better Please.
Yeah.
It was a series of things. It was partly in response to the previous show, Love Letters. So Love Letters was about soliciting... dedications of love from our audience, it moved audiences and gave people a chance to say things that they wouldn't otherwise get to say to loved ones of one sort or another. But it was about love, and it tended to create a sort of consensus in the audience, a sort of loving consensus. And it was passionate, but. Also very sweet, hopefully. And I guess we wanted to react a little bit to that, to make a show that was less about people's kind of internal expressions of emotion and more about people's responses to the world around them, the world of politics and economics and world affairs and that sort of thing. So I suppose it was partly a reaction to the previous show. It was also about our feeling, our awareness of a kind of increased interest in politics and what was happening in the world, in the kind of shifting of the political landscape with coalition government coming into power a couple of years ago. And an awareness of a kind of repoliticisation of certain groups in society. So those are a couple of the reasons why we decided to make Better Please.
Yes, it has been referred to as something of an antidote to love letters. I mean, in terms of the form of it, the other thing I suppose we were interested in was was developing our interest in collaboration with the audience. With the audience being involved in some way in authoring the show. So the risk with Make Better Please is that whereas with love letters people wrote their dedications to loved ones and made requests for songs in advance, and we had some chance to write a score to organise those into a structure, with Make Better Please the risk is that it's day specific, it's specific to the newspapers of the day, and the content of the show is generated out of conversation with the audience there and then on the night.
So starting from the beginning then, we the audience walk in and we essentially start by sitting around coffee tables and having tea and biscuits over the newspapers. And then do you want to take us on from there?
Yeah, well, I mean, we like the fact that you walk in, hopefully, to a space that doesn't necessarily feel like a theatre space, but feels, and although we would say it is framed by the theatre space, and you are walking into a theatre work, at the same time, hopefully, you walk into a space that feels a lot like a Sunday morning in a cafe, reading the newspapers and having conversations around them over cups of tea, which, might, I guess, be something familiar from a Sunday morning in a cafe or, gathering with family around the newspapers at the kitchen table. Initially you're simply invited to read the newspapers and to drink tea and to eat some biscuits, and it's all terribly convivial. And then gradually we start to, I guess, facilitate discussion, and the discussion moves on to encouraging people to find bad news stories, which of course aren't especially hard to find in the newspapers, and then to decide on a particular story that they think should really matter on this day, and is perhaps the story that makes them the most angry in the newspapers on that day. And then discussion starts to happen, and discussion happens amongst the groups, and then eventually we come together. So the groups come together into a larger circle, which and the form of this part of the show draws on Quaker meetings. So when we were developing the show, when we were researching the show, we went to a number of Quaker meetings and were very both moved by them and really interested in the structure of them, the way that a kind of collective ministry is made. So rather than having a single preacher who gives the sermon, the sermon is told collectively and and through different people choosing to stand and tell stories out of the silence.
So this is the bit where we start sharing the stories that we found, mm-hmm. And start, I suppose, picking them apart as a group, as a whole, rather than the individual tables. What sort of stories have come up along the way? What sort recur? What tends to get people's goat?
It's so diverse, isn't it? I mean, and it's really depends on the kind of temperature of the room, the kind of people that happen to be in there, what their particular politics are, and of course that part relates to the context within which the piece is being presented, whether it's being presented in a theatre festival where we get a lot of people like us
and like you, Matt,
or in, you know, we've done a bit of rural touring and obviously the audience there is quite different. So yeah, it really differs. So the whole kind of, a whole range of issues come up. I remember people getting very irate about education in this country. I remember a particularly passionate speech by somebody in a place called Berrynarbor in North Devon about that, about the way, by a teacher actually, about the whole inspection system, Ofsted, and what that means for kids and the kind of production line mentality that it creates. So yeah, people talking about that. People sometimes talk about the way stories are being presented, the kind of the media.
Yeah.
And the, you know, obviously we've been touring this show at the same time that the Leveson inquiry has been going on, so that's provided a sort of bit of a backdrop for it. And so people get angry about Murdoch and his ownership of so much of the news media in this country. We had last night here at Battersea Arts Centre, we had a big rant about the Olympics and people getting, you know, kicked out of flats in East London to make so that landlords can rent flats for a lot more money to people who are coming for the Olympics. A whole range of things.
One of the things I found really interesting about that section, discussing it, particularly in the small group, was how everything suddenly seemed to relate. And coalesce together, and you went, well, yeah, because that relates to, you know, and I think someone was talking about James Cameron going off to mine asteroids with his billions of pounds, and suddenly that was relating to a very local news story. I can't exactly remember what it was, but something to do with local cuts, and suddenly the whole thing seemed to click together. And
that sometimes happens, yeah, organically. Not always, but sometimes people themselves make those connections between things, and I think that is... That is really, it's like there's one story which is, I don't know, yeah. Sometimes it's about, again, about the media, the way all these stories are being presented in those newspapers. Sometimes it's some overarching narrative around kind of capitalist system we all live in, and that, you know. But yes, people often, I mean, we don't push that, I don't think.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the example Richard gave is a good example, in a way, because the teacher who stood up in Berrynarbor took, in a way, well, he retold in his own words a story from the newspaper that was a political story, but then he made a personal connection, and he made a personal connection about how a particular news story was affecting him and had impacted on him and his teaching in that particular community. So that was an interesting example. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think in those small groups, those connections are kind of made. And for instance, I don't know, I had a conversation last night where one person had chosen a story that I think was titled Richopolis, which I think was in The Guardian yesterday. And, you know, they started talking about how London is trying to attract oligarchs, mm-hmm. and trying to attract wealth. And they happened to be sitting next to someone who was talking, who had found a story that was instead about, you know, the cutting of benefits for poor families. So those two stories kind of sat kind of next to each other.
Yeah.
And the group started to make those kinds of connections. But sometimes I think it also kind of speaks instead of the kind of the way that stories are presented alongside each other in the newspaper without there being any conjunction, or, you know, the way that some kind of entertainment news or some celebrity news might sit very uncomfortably in juxtaposition with you know, perhaps a story that's about kind of international news or, mm. you know, that mm. has very, very different content. And I think that hopefully what's happening, as well as participating in those discussions, I hope that, you know, in a way those discussions are staged, that you might reflect on the way that we do treat news as entertainment,
yeah.
and the way that we do sit around our table on a Sunday morning, and we are entertained by journalistic reports of you know, being on the front line. We feel a little satisfied, or a little more satisfied, by simply the knowledge, by knowing what's happening in the world, and by journalists going out as witnesses and coming back and telling us what's taking place. And that makes us feel a little bit more kind of content in ourselves, but hopefully we're also questioning in this work, you know, that news as entertainment, and the way that simply knowing makes us feel a little bit closer to doing something.
Mm. I suppose with the Quaker meeting section, as the connections come out and you start to, as you say, critique the very things you've just been looking at the initial stages of it, it seems to gather a bit of momentum, and I mean almost centrifugal force comes into it, and then I suppose we start taking that on into the room. The news stories become present in a way they weren't. Could you say a little bit about that process? Describe it to us.
Well, it shifts into a section, doesn't it, or a couple of different sections. One in which Richard and Jess, the performers, simply announce that they are particular figures in the news. For instance, you know, Richard might say, I am Boris Johnson, and the audience have an opportunity to ask questions of Richard standing in for Boris Johnson. Who perhaps unsurprisingly doesn't really give you the answer you might be looking for. But in a way, a conversation starts to happen through Richard and through the performers standing in for these figures in the news. And a conversation starts to happen actually between the audience, at least when it's at its best. And then there's a shift towards getting towards the performers and also the audience. So casting the audience into some of the stories from the news. So each day there'll be two or three stories from the news that we work with and in a little bit more detail, and that we stage and very simply ask the audience to stand in for the people in those news stories. And I guess we hope that what that might do is it might bring those stories into the room, and it might allow us to kind of, I suppose, measure the distance between ourselves and the people in those stories. That's, I guess, what we're hoping is happening there. That you know, the people in the stories do become kind of personified, and we do start to think about a little bit about what if we were that yeah. was happening here. What if that was happening to us?
So, Richard, in terms of taking on these essentially a lot of the time villains and these people that we are directing our anger towards, what does it feel like to be that straw man at that moment?
How is it being the scapegoat?
It feels like. I mean, the interesting thing is how much, if you say it with conviction, I am Boris Johnson, I am David Cameron, I am Nick Clegg, whatever, whoever it is, when you look in people's eyes, how much, you know, after a while, after a few of them, there is a sense of them suspending their disbelief and sort of, you know, sort of believing that maybe you are. And out comes some unedited bit of abuse or whatever, you know, or well, sophisticated political comment.
Yeah, you've been asked both, haven't you? You've been asked quite sophisticated political questions.
Or you're just told
to get
lost.
Quite searching political questions, or you're simply insulted.
Yes, all that.
Am I right in thinking you don't respond at that point?
We don't.
Well, verbally.
We don't, which is partly just a sort of... We did try. Through the development process, we did try and imagine, you know, if we were really trying to empathise with the person that we were representing, what their comeback might be. But it became just a bit corny and crass and like some bad soap opera or some bad interview on the Today programme or something. And I think we became more, and it became too much about us, I suppose, and our cleverness or not at thinking on our feet and coming up with an answer. I think we were then became more interested in us being a bit of a kind of MacGuffin, an excuse for a conversation between the audience, hopefully. And also, it sort of felt like there was something there about powerful people and how reachable or not they are, how willing to answer direct questions or not they are. So I guess that's why we decided not to respond in the end. Also, because I think it encourages the suspension of disbelief as soon as we start to open our mouth at that point and try and provide some sort of rational answer, it'll just, people will be immediately able to pick holes in it and see that it's not, you know, it's, we haven't done enough research or whatever it is, you know, the illusion will be lost.
Sure.
So, yeah.
So then, I suppose after these two sections have become one, something bursts. It then moves into this much more ritualistic phase and keeps gathering that momentum. Talk us through that bit, or those bits, I suppose.
Well, I suppose we were in our process. We were quite inspired by and interested in. You know, we were looking at material. We were looking at exorcisms. We were looking at seances, and we were looking at a particular. We watched a particular Jean Rouch film called Les Maîtres Fous, which is about a kind of cargo cult called the Hulka, and. In their particular ritual, they end up kind of, you know, doing what you might expect of, you know, of a possession, frothing at the mouth, and you know, I mean, you track this particular possession. They sort of break a taboo. They eat a dog, which is breaking a taboo. They end up sort of frothing at the mouth and kind of. You know, certainly appearing to be absolutely possessed, but rather than being possessed by, you know, I guess a kind of god or a spirit, they're possessed by the spirit of one of the local colonial powers. So they become possessed by, you know, the colonel of the guard or something, or I think even the locomotive driver is one of the people they've become possessed by, and part of their possession also seems to involve an amount of mimicry. And parody. I mean, it looks certainly to our, you know, Western eyes, it looks a lot like parody. And so, you know, they're sort of performing what really look like silly walks, and it's very funny and kind of disturbing. And you know, they're in a way drawing on the power of, and perhaps they think also kind of sapping the power of these political powers, these colonial powers. So we sort of thought, well, what would it be like to do that in the UK? What would this look like? What would a kind of, you know, contemporary kind of possession in the UK that, you know, if we imagine a sort of cargo cult in the UK, what might they do? So we were trying to imagine a kind of version of this. So I suppose what's happening is Richard is... and he's improvising, so that, you know, sometimes they're the same people, sometimes they're different people, but it's a kind of sort of shamanic possession in which he's becoming possessed by David Cameron, Nick Clegg. Not sure that he's necessarily someone you can draw much power from at the moment. But various kind of political figures. And the idea, I guess, is that through kind of taking on the power of or becoming these different political figures, Richard might gain something of the power to then do something about the stories that have come up that yeah. day, the bad news. So there's a shift that then happens where Richard does kind of become the scapegoat, and
yeah.
He starts to kind of, well, Jess starts to put upon him, I guess, the kind of bad news of the day, and he starts to take that on.
One thing, I mean, it's very interesting to hear you talk about the humour of that initial influence. That was what really struck me, was the fact that it was these images were just so absurd to see Richard sort of strutting about, clucking about, and gradually, I suppose we should have had at this point that two figures in essentially these grass costumes but made out of newspaper come in, and it's just ridiculous to look at, and yet there is something taboo. The mask of that we're given of what, yesterday's obituary columns, or are they?
Yeah, well, they're masks made from every week, from the previous week. So yeah, at a certain point in the show, the audience are given masks of faces that are people's faces that are made from the recent obituary pages, and that's precisely has that effect. So you're in a way crossing a certain line,
yeah.
aren't you? You are sort of breaking the taboo when we ask you to put on those masks of the recently dead, and in a way also calling on those people and bringing those kind of good ghosts into the room. We kind of hope, but you also point to something really important for us, where I think. And maybe it's one of the things that people do find really complicated about the show, because in a way, I think you're put in a very strange position, and we know that you are in that moment, because it's sort of hysterical, but it's also very committed.
Yep.
So it's kind of hysterical, kind of committed, and you sort of don't know how to position yourself or how to place yourself. And some people laugh, some people look uncomfortable, and I think it's very hard in that moment, and I think we know that it is, to kind of position yourself or know what you should do with this or how to be in response to it as an audience.
I suppose it seems to me that there's a real tension between the patent absurdity of even attempting something like this and attempting it with forms that are so very definitely outmoded and or perceived to be outmoded. And the fact that maybe, just maybe, it might be working at some higher level. And that sense of teenagers around a Ouija board that you just something puts you on edge. And then I suppose we come to the final stage, which is this you as bad news are chased from the room with fire extinguishers. And there is a lull in the middle of World War One, I suppose. It feels like that sort of, oh, what a lovely warm moment where the birds might start tweeting. And we're just left hanging. Why does it feel important to end on that note of optimism after that?
Well, maybe before we do come to the optimism, we should say that what this sort of shamanic ritual eventually kind of builds into is something much more like a kind of rock gig. So there is kind of, so eventually drums come in, bass comes in, smoke machines. By this point, Richard is, and you'll have to imagine this image, Richard is has been adorned with a sort of giant phallus made out of newspaper and a giant sort of belly, also kind of roughly made out of newspaper. And the stories that the audience chose at the beginning come back. So the text from those stories that the audience chose at the beginning has been written up all around the walls on kind of placards through the performance. And Jess starts to use those texts as the kind of lyrics for a sort of punk song, a kind of doom metal song. Maybe song is a bit of a grand term for it. A kind of rant. A sort of venting kind of punk sort of angry rant, but kind of using the text that's written up on the walls and comes out of the stories that people chose earlier on, and those are all kind of directed at Richard. So the idea is that he becomes the scapegoat. So hopefully the in a way this noise has kind of purged something and cleaned your head a bit, and coming out of that noise, the windows are opened, the curtains are opened, you start to see the street lights from outside, hear the traffic from the street outside, and we come into a silence, but we hope a silence in which things feel somewhat changed. And yes, out of that, people are invited then to speak stories of hope.
Yeah.
And those stories of hope might be stories that are from the newspapers, from radio or from TV, but quite often are much more local. Quite often are stories that are much more that shift the attention to the people in the room, to things that people have experienced themselves, that might have to do with an engagement with politics, but might also not. Might simply have to do with kind of acts of kindness that people have experienced in their own lives in the preceding day.
I suppose the two things that really, really interested me most of all about this piece were, one, and love letters as well, you tend to work with the emotions, I think, and the thoughts are left to us. Not in the sense that we're generating the material, but just in that it's presented quite matter-of-fact and detached. Is that a very conscious thing, and how does it relate to the liveness of the event?
I mean, you're right, we're not really commenting on the stories. And in a way, we're in this, the audience, in a way, present a lot of the stories in the words they choose to. And, you know, I guess some of those might be presented in a very articulate and, you know, very knowledgeable way, and others less so. And we simply allow those stories to kind of sit there. And I think in our performances in this also, yeah, we're in a way presenting this news, and we're telling these stories, and I think there is quite a lot of work probably for you to do to then reflect on that, to start to make some narrative from that. But yeah, I think that hopefully it does also take you through an experience that at least has the kind of potential to move you. And sometimes they get moved. Sometimes they get moves people, and sometimes not. Sometimes it's much more. Sometimes it's much more likely to leave you with questions, I think.
Sure.
Reflecting on ideas as much as being moved. And again, it's so collaborative that it really depends what's in the room on the night and what comes up.
With that in mind, then, I suppose I found it very interesting to think of it in terms of political theatre. And we think of political theatre, we think of issue-driven, quite specific, often quite well-researched piece. And this is almost the opposite. It's very non-specific and deliberately so. How do you guys relate the work and your work to politics? You said this was your first sort of foray into it.
I mean, I'm no expert on political theatre. That's the first thing to say. I don't think any of us, well, you might be bored, but I'm not. But I guess, I don't know, I mean, we don't pretend to have any kind of clear political manifesto. we're not a new writing company who are sort of sitting down and constructing a play which has a kind of clear set of political perspectives, I suppose, or political agenda. I suppose we're more interested in encouraging the audience to ask questions of themselves about their relationship with the world around them, and how they are connected or not with people who are not themselves, and places in the world that are not here, and how they might feel responsible or not for those people and places, and how they might feel like they are able to be agents of change or not, and you know, and whether the media encourages us to feel capable of changing things or actually the opposite. It just makes us go, oh my goodness, it's all so depressing, and it is the way it is, and it will always be thus, and You know, politicians are assholes, and the media is all owned by one person, and that's just it. Hey ho, let's get our lives. Let's carry on reading the papers and drinking tea. And so, I guess it's about sort of defamiliarising our relationship with the media, with newspapers, with the news culture, with the people with power in our lives, over our lives. Defamiliarising those relationships, not taking them for granted, in order that change becomes possible. That it's like, you know, you make it weird in order for people to go, okay, it doesn't have to be like this. We don't have to treat these people with respect. They sound very reasonable. Actually, you know, maybe they're seriously malevolent figures and should be treated thus and should be chased out of the room with a fire extinguisher. Why not, you know, rather than, you know, taking them on their own terms and having that today-like, you know, Newsnight-like kind of political conversation. So just tell them to get lost.
It's almost an intervention in the news cycle, the way we receive them. Yeah.
I think it's about, and rather than being political theatre in the old sense of kind of having an agenda that or a particular kind of message that you want to communicate, I think it simply makes a space in which the audience have an opportunity to think about politics and to think about their relationship to politics and the kinds of responsibilities that Richard's talking about. But the politics, in a way, can be quite diverse. And is the political voices of those in the room who don't tend, perhaps, to get to stand up and get on their soapbox and voice their political political opinion.
In a way, the piece is almost functioning as a machine, a process that we as audience come in one side and leave the other.
Yeah, and whether you leave, in a way, you know, I think some people have been sort of, I don't know, frustrated by the fact that they don't leave satisfied or leave kind of feeling like, you know, catharsis has been achieved. And of course we do set up something that has the potential to have a kind of, to produce some kind of sense of catharsis. We are kind of drawing on I guess, sort of sacred rituals that we're kind of making quite profane, I guess, that could kind of have the potential to produce some, you know, feeling of catharsis, I guess. But really, this idea of kind of make better pleas is, it's a kind of cry, it's kind of scream or a kind of shout. It's not, we don't really expect people to come out the other side feeling like, you know, drinking tea with us and kind of going through this sort of punk rock kind of slightly teenage kind of angst driven kind of rant will actually have cured things, will actually have made things better in the world. Rather, we hope that people will kind of walk off, you know, into the night reflecting instead on what they might actually have to do. Well, and the kind of steps they could really take, you know, to maybe make at least some kind of small change.
I certainly think you did that, and I think the piece achieves this quite incredible sense of catharsis. Thank you both very much.
Very good. Thanks for having us.